My name is Mike Lorenz. I'm an alcoholic. My dry date, September 7th, 1985. And that amazes me. I was one of those reluctant to recover. And as a matter of fact, I started over enough times that when they gave me my last start over token, they told me the next one would be in suppository form if this one didn't work. So there is hope if you're struggling. I think. Well, I want to thank everybody. Putting on an event like this takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And Larry and the committees and everybody that's had a hand in it, I want to thank. And so let's give those guys a hand now, too. And it's been wonderful this weekend. You really have, the reading was talking about creating the fellowship we crave, and you've obviously created a wonderful fellowship here, and I want to thank you for sharing it with me. It's been a wonderful opportunity to connect with some old friends and to make new friends and to just kind of bathe in the fellowship of the Spirit this weekend. And I didn't know that's what I craved when I got here. Well, let me back up. Let me start out with the hard part here. I got a first step that I could hang on to as a result of finally writing an inventory. And I'm going to share with you the piece of the inventory where I really understood to the core of my being exactly how powerless I was. And this piece of inventory is about my college sweetheart. I was engaged to her. She was the love of my life, the girl of my dreams, the woman I wanted to have my children with, spend the rest of my life with, grow old with. I loved her parents. I loved her siblings. I loved everything about it. I loved her dad just like a rainbow. He was a wonderful friend. With all of that, here's the best I could do. It's about Ellen. Where was I selfish? I wanted to enjoy sex with her regardless of the consequences. Where was I dishonest? I told her not to worry, that I'd always be there for her no matter what. I dishonestly refused to consider my ability to keep that promise. I aroused jealousy. I told her if she didn't have sex with me, then I'd get it elsewhere. I paid undue attention to other women in her presence and told her how attractive I found them. Isn't that a wonderful way to treat the woman you love? Suspicion. I aroused suspicion. I often spent time alone with other women, and she found me at Holly's apartment. And I aroused bitterness. When she became pregnant, I told her that I doubted that it was my child. I told her mother I was too young to get married, and I didn't want to marry her anyway. And when she was in California having our baby, I made drunken phone calls to harangue her, and because she was in California and I was back home, I told everybody that she'd run off and abandon me. Who did I harm? Well, the baby, Ellen, her family, my family, our friends. Then we get to that critical turning point here. What should I have done instead? Don told me, by the way, that about anything would be an improvement over what I did. But this is important because this starts to give me a vision of what life could be like if I'm willing to put it in God's hands. And it says I should have treated sex as the sacred gift that it is. I shouldn't have engaged in behavior that I wasn't willing to be responsible for. I should have honestly faced the consequences of my actions. I should have been honest with myself and others. My harms were all rooted in dishonesty, particularly about how afraid I was. Self-reliance is always going to produce fear and pain. Now, I wish I could tell you that's the last problem I had, but it wasn't. But it was the beginning of the answer. When I when I asked for help with this work, and it wasn't the first time, but at this particular time when I approached Don to help me with this work, he says, "Why do you want to do this?" And I says, "Oh, Don, I want to get better." And he says, "Oh, please, you've spent your entire life trying to get better and it's nearly killed you. Why don't we see if you can get free?" And I realized that I'd been a guy, I'm like a man that's a prisoner in a jail, and my vision is so limited that I'm just trying to trade for a better cell with a better view of the yard and maybe some more privileges and everything else, but I'm still in jail. It never occurred to me that I could be free. I had my first drink when I was about 11 years old, and that's the first drink that did anything for me. There wasn't a sip off daddy's wine or mom's beer or something like that. And I need to pause and tell you that I don't know that I'm from a normal family, but I'm from a functional family. The family had problems. You know, we'd have problems from time to time, frequently generated by me. But what happened is the family didn't go crazy. They faced up to the problems and dealt with them. Pretty generally talked honestly about them and worked through them. And the reason it's important for me to tell you about that is that I lied about that family for a long time. Because when my life started going off the rails and people asked me what was wrong with me, well, you know, my parents were older, you know, I got postponed because of World War II, and by the time they had me, they were older, and they didn't understand. And then they were inconsiderate enough to have three more children. I should have been enough. And yeah, part of my sister will tell you that she came along when I was 3 years old, and my request that from Santa Claus that Christmas was that he make her disappear and take her back to wherever she'd come from. The sad part of it was is that although I had two brothers and a sister, I lived in that family like I was an only child. So I'm 11 years old, and I don't know, but I'm an 11-year-old that needs a drink. Come to find out, I've always been a power seeker. Up until that period of time, I'm getting my power by pleasing adults. I'm the guy you don't like having to come over to your house because I'm going to suck up to your mother and your dad. Oh, well, Mrs. Cleaver, can I help clear those dishes for you? Yeah. And I'm not doing any of this because I'm a good kid. I'm doing it because I intuitively get that there's some power in pleasing these adults that seem to have power and decide what's going on. And the same thing, I work in the principal's office in school as a volunteer. And, you know, I belong to the normal array of organizations. And I made a mistake around an Al-Anon once that described myself as a people pleaser. And he set me right. And he says, "Mike, first of all," he says, "give me a list of all those people you've pleased till they just can't stand it anymore." And then he went to describe the truth of my condition. He says, "You're not a people pleaser. You don't really care about people. What you're doing is you're an approval sucker." And that doesn't sound nearly as nice as people. But what happened to me, I found out later when I was 11 years old, was described on page 27 of our textbook, where Carl Jung is talking to Roland Hazard. And Roland's been having some difficulties here. And essentially, Dr. Jung has just told him he's hopeless and there really isn't a solution for him. And he pleads with the doctor, say, "Isn't there anything?" And he says, "Well, once in a while, from time to time, you know, these men have what are called vital spiritual experiences. Ideas and emotions that have governed the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a new set of conceptions take hold. And see, I didn't realize that that's what happened to 11-year-old Mike when I got that first vodka down and I felt the effect of it. I didn't know that I was an 11-year-old that needed a spiritual awakening and a spiritual experience, and I accidentally got one out of a bottle, and I kept trying to steal them from a bottle ever after to fill that hole that Gary was talking about. My drinking pretty much bores me, but I'll give you a couple snapshots to prove that I belong, then we'll kind of maybe move on to some things that might be more valuable. Say I'm 15 years old. I know I'm not old enough to drive, and I grew up in a little town in Iowa, a college town, about 50, 60,000 people then, about 25,000 at the University of Iowa. Iowa City was the name of this little town. And it was kind of in the 50s, it was a beaver cleaver kind of place. You left your doors open unless you went on vacation, and you know, often as not, the keys were in the cars and all that sort of stuff. Around our block, on Friday or Saturday night, if the weather was decent, all the men had gathered the barbecue grills together where the yards met in the back, and you know, whoever had caught some fish that time or had some ribs or whatever, we'd have a neighborhood gathering. So that's the town I'm growing up in, and then we got the university there. And it's the middle of the week, maybe a Wednesday night, and my friends bring me home and do a drive-by and just kind of roll me out of the car in front of my house. And I'm making a bunch of noise getting in the house. And my mother's got the sharp ears, you know, "Mike, that you?" And I lost my mind and I swore at her. Now, this was a bad idea. As I told you yesterday, I kind of favor my mom. My father went to Drake University on a footballer scholarship to play tackle for them. And so when I swore at my mom, that got my dad up. Now, he's a big, powerful guy, but he was a gentle guy. And he'd come out and he'd say, "Mike, you're not going to talk to your mother like that. You need to behave, son." And I'd do the next insane thing. I'd take a swing at him. And thank God he had mercy on me, and he just didn't flat deck me. You know, he'd try and restrain me. And so what would be happening, and I'm 15, I'm big enough to cause him a little trouble to try and hold down. So next thing, Dad and I are rolling around on the kitchen floor, and I'm trying to slam his head into a cabinet. And it's all this noise has awakened my sister and brothers. And they're up, and they're crying, and they're afraid their daddy and their big brother are going to hurt each other. And give you another little snapshot. A couple years later, probably, I think I'm maybe a 17 by this time, because I'm driving, but haven't graduated yet. And we're having a little family meeting around the kitchen table, and my sister's hope chest is sitting in the middle of this table. And we're having the meeting. The subject of the meeting is what happened to the money in Carol's hope chest. And they seem to be focused on me. And I did what I learned to do my whole life. I looked him right. I knew you had to, if you're going to lie, you got to look him right in the eye. I looked him right in the eye and said, "I can't understand why you're asking me about any of this. How would I have any idea what happened to Carol's money?" And of course, her big brother had taken her money. And I'd gone out the weekend before and bought a keg for my friends so I could be the big guy throwing the party out at the lake that weekend. And the reason I mention that stuff to you is because I got here thinking that I'd enjoyed a period of normal drinking, that I was this young executive that had this this great war record and then kind of a little meteoric business career, and I'd somehow just been tripped up by alcoholism in my early 30s. And that was, of course, a lie. I man that, one of the men that helped me, he pointed out, he says, Mike, he says, the way I see it, that you were bringing violence into your home and you were stealing to support your habit when you were as a teenager, and that doesn't fit any description of social drinking I've ever heard. And so I think I was pretty much always, I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic just waiting to have the alcohol added so I could blossom. Into my drinking, I've... all the stuff is gone. Alcohol did things for me. I couldn't stay in school, unfortunately. I made a very terrible error. I went on spring break in 1966 and decided not to come back and take my finals because the partying was too good. That was a grave error in 1966, and that got me introduced to Uncle Sam. But I'm still an alcoholic because they drafted me, and that would have been a 2-year commitment, and you weren't going to tell me what to do. I went down and signed up for 3 years. Yeah, that keen alcoholic mind, you know. I was able to go to New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Nashville, in places, and engage in business. I was able to, oddly, Vietnam was probably had more sober time than any period of my life up until I got sober, because I was an infantryman down in the Delta, and you can't walk around in booby traps and be stoned and survive. We had the expression at the time is the guys that were stoners on that. The stoners were back in the motor pool for the most part, because if you were walking around in the booby traps and you were messed up, you were going to self-select out was the description for it. And I had that graphically demonstrated. I wasn't in country very long. We were pulling into a little night defensive position, and I knew one of our medics liked to keep... stuff in his kit, and we were setting up that defensive perimeter, and I heard this whoof, and I turned around, and I saw Doc's boot with part of his leg in it doing just a slow cartwheel in the sky, and I got it. I was, at that time, I had enough control, and I was scared enough that I wasn't going to, I was able to control my drinking. Into my drinking, I'm all the houses gone, the cars gone, all this stuff. I'd come to AA once at this point, or a couple times actually, to save a relationship. The first time I showed up, I was driving a new car and wearing a cashmere coat, and you know, and all that. I entertained a bunch of old timers to no end. I tried to actually explain to them that I was a high-end drunk. This was a different kind. And old Red says, young fella, I reckon you are, since your ass is where your head ought to be. And and needless to say, I didn't stay sober. But I'm now the jobs are gone, everything's gone, and I'm... I used to say I was living with a woman. I was living off a woman, is the truth. And I'm a functional alcoholic. She's got a job and goes to work and pays the rent. I didn't realize it till later on that she had me on an allowance. She'd go to work, and when she'd come home, before she'd come in the apartment, she'd decide how much money she was going to let me steal that night, and that's how much she'd leave in her purse, and the rest of it go under the carpet in the trunk of the car, and she'd come in, and we'd pretend that we had a relationship, and then she'd go to bed because she had to work, and I'd be in her purse and out the back door and off to do my thing. And by the way, you got to live that way, too, one day at a time. You can't really be looking out too far and live like that. My day started, I'd get up whenever I could get up, and I had to have a drink in order to do anything, to get dressed. And so I'd go out to the kitchen, I'd make a drink, and I'd go sit on the edge of the tub by the toilet and try and get the first drink to stay down. And some days it did, some days it didn't. Day after day, and I've been treated, and my friends and my drinking buddies, the one to need it. I'm the last one of the crew that doesn't get this. I've tried to go to every Happy Acres spot they've been to and find the magic, and it didn't work. One of, maybe it was Tim that was saying it the other day, I was a very compliant person when you treated me. In fact, that's one of the things that scared me. I started to realize that I was beginning to institutionalize well. And I'm go walking around this treatment center, and I've got a legal pad, and I'm taking notes on everything anybody says, you know, and you know, because I'm gonna. This is the answer. Somebody's gonna drop the secret, and I'm gonna get it. Finally, this one counselor has got my number, and he says, walks up to me. He says, Mike. He says, you need to understand. He says, you're a patient here, not a consultant, and. So with that, I had no reason to hope that there was going to be any future for me at all. But on grace of God, one day my sail caught the wind on that bathroom floor, and I got an idea that I got to try and get sober again. And there's no more insurance and stuff. So I tell the gal about it when she comes home. She thinks that's a great idea. She goes, fills my tank up with gas, gives me a $20 bill and a pint of light Bacardi rum, and she sent me off to find sobriety. Now, I'm living in Indianapolis by this time, but I'm confused enough that, you know, I know the only thing that's going to take me is going to be a veteran center, and the only one I can remember is in a place called Knoxville, Iowa, about 500 miles away. And so I set off for Knoxville, Iowa, and it's September Labor Day weekend, hotter than hell. And I've got a drunk car with no air conditioning, and I run out of the rum, and I can't make it the last 100 miles. And where I pull up is I'm at the exit on Interstate 80 by my old hometown. Now my dad's dead by this time, but my mom still lives there, and two of my brothers live there. And I know today they would have gladly helped me, but I couldn't go to them anymore. The peace in me that had broke is all of a sudden knew that if I loved you, I was going to hurt you. And what happened was that up until that time, I could lie to you and I could hurt you with impunity, and I lost my ability to just look at the people that I knew loved me and continue to hurt them. So where I ended up there was on the front porch of my the father of my best friend and drinking buddy from high school, old Buck. And Buck had been a paratrooper in World War II, and I'd been down at Benning, and so Buck and I had an affinity for each other. And Buck, when I was in the service, he'd a week or so before payday, I'd get a letter from Buck, and it'd have a $20 bill in it. And a note usually along the lines that says, I know damn well you're broke by now. Here, take this and have a party on me. And PX beer was 10 cents a bottle then. So, you know, $20, 10 cents a bottle, you know, you do the math. And so Buck was he was not only the father of my best friend, he was a drinking buddy. I mean, I liked Buck's style. Buck got taken to jail in his own car. Buck rear-ended a cop car and disabled it, and so the officer had no choice but to take him to jail in his own car. But a terrible thing had happened. Buck and his wife had gotten sober a few years before, and I thought they'd gone religious, you know, because they even went to church, if you can believe a thing like that. And they prayed and all this stuff, and I had no use for him. I think probably church puppies was the nicest thing I'd call them. I'm dying. I can't make the last 100 miles, and I'm on their doorstep. And And they were both there in that living room, and Buck and Nettie both came to the front door. They looked at me, and then they looked at each other, and then they both reached out together and just drew me into that living room. And right then and there, without anything further being said, they both put their arms around me and said a prayer for me to get better. And then Buck was a practical man. He gave me a drink and put me to bed. And got me up the next day and gave me another drink and drove me the last 100 miles. And he and I, he's gone now, but we talked about it many times. But about the only thing we could both agree on and remember from that trip was that I'd keep reaching over and grabbing his shoulder, and I was crying, and I'd say, Buck, how do I get this God stuff? How do I get this God stuff? Please tell me, how do I get this God stuff? And if he answered me, we didn't, neither one of us remembered what the answer had been. What I believe today to the core of my being, that my I ended up at the treatment center, and there's all the stories that go with that, but they hadn't changed anything. They still had the same pretty much 12 steps, and it was all the same deal. What had changed, and what had changed for me, see, I don't think my journey was so much a journey to that treatment center as it was a journey to that prayer. For the first time, I was willing to stand still and not push you back or swear at you. I just let you, okay, if you're going to pray for me, pray for me. And I was, I made two vital decisions there in that treatment center. One was that I somehow needed to have a relationship with God. And the other one was that I needed to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not somebody who just kept a seat warm in the meetings. I'd been plenty of times. I'd give you my opinions and everything else. But I'd never really been a member. I tell you another little bit. When I got out of that... you know, the family that I'd said all those bad things about, at the end of the day, that one brother of mine that I'd put down, he'd take his days off while I was in that treatment center and come 100 miles on a little motorcycle to have lunch with his brother. And they'd all come see me, and they'd take their time, and you know, and it wasn't easy. When I got out of that treatment center, I did what all good 30-something successful alcoholics do. I went home to mommy's, and I couldn't get back to Indianapolis right away. And I, in case you think you need special conditions in order to get sober, my first night out of treatment, I was back in my old bedroom at my mom's house, but my youngest brother, who's not one of us, none of them are, I had just started his career as a wine distributor, and my old bedroom was his first warehouse. And so my first night out of treatment, I'm my mom put a rollaway bed there, and I've got cases of wine stacked to the ceiling on three sides of me. But I've surrendered, and I'm safe and protected. And I went back to Indianapolis eventually, and I began my career as a junior guru in AA. I met Gary when I was about, met would be too strong a word. I encountered Gary when I was about 90 days sober, and I'm 90 days sober, and he's 45 years old and getting a 21-year token. And he's up there getting that token, and you got to understand, he's like a GQ model, and all these women are going, "Oh my God, it's him! Oh, he's so tall and gorgeous and handsome, and he's sober 21 years, and oh Jesus, you know, give me a break." And what really upset me was, my married girlfriend thought he was cute too. And, I got to mention this. My second sponsor did me a great favor because he fired me. I'd come into alcohol. I'm staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I somehow find myself, I'm dating a married woman. I'm sponsoring her 16-year-old son, and I'm playing euchre on the weekends with her husband, and he's a gun-toting federal agent. And my second sponsor, George, grabbed me in the parking lot after a meeting one day, and he says, "Mike," he says, "I got to let you go." He says, "Every time I confront you about your behavior here," he says, you manage to explain it to me in such a way as that I start to think it's God's will. I know it's insane. I can't be around you." Now, my teachers require me to repeat that humiliating bit of stuff. I'd like to airbrush that off the resume. I think there ought to be a statute of limitations on that, that, you know, or like your credit report, after so long it kind of drops off. But they tell me that there may be other people like me making mistakes like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you need to know, in my experience, that you don't have to get drunk. I was fortunate enough not to get shot, but I did have to change my behavior. Our book talks about that. You know, if I'm one of the few negative promises in the big book is in that piece about our sexual conduct inventory. And it says, you know, if we continue to harm others with our behavior, we're probably sure to get drunk. They don't threaten us many times in that book, but that's one time that they pretty much put it out there. I made that mistake, but with your help and God's help, I remedied that behavior. I met and married after that, not that woman, but another woman in AA, and I've got a family going. I've got a son. I've got a, you know, it's a picture. I've got a new career. I'm approaching my fifth year in sobriety. I never even imagined I could have 5 years of sobriety. And it's wonderful. I mean, I'm on every committee you can ever find. I grab a hold of all the time, go 10 or 11 meetings a week. I never miss a dance, you know, a function, anything. And I'm dying inside. I got the happy face. Oh, I founded my own meeting. Of course, everybody needs to found their own meeting. It's part of the humility shtick. I'm a complete fake in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like one of those big, we used to get them, those big chocolate hollow Easter bunnies that you'd see at Easter, and they're, you know, they look all big and puffy, but there isn't anything inside of them. The best I can do, I love my wife, I love my son, but I know I'm failing. I'm doing stuff like, I remember yet Andrew was 4 years old, and I'm backing out of the driveway on Sunday, and he comes running up to the car and he says, "Oh, Mike," he says, can't you stay home? Can't you stay home and play with me? We could do, you know." And I said, "No, I really, Andrew, I wish I could." I says, "But I got some work I got to do." And that was a lie. I went to the office and I sat there playing solitaire on the computer and shuffling paper. I didn't need to be there, but I didn't know how to be with that family. I had no clue. I loved them, but that wasn't sufficient. So where I am at this point in time is I'm this AA success story is I'm really just, the best I can come up with is try and figure out a way for me to kill myself so it doesn't embarrass the people I sponsor. And this is not a vision for you. And about this time, I bump into Gary here again. And God's got a sense of humor. There's a Sunday meeting up on the north side at the hotel, a fancy hotel at this time, and it was one of those white tablecloth deals and china coffee cups and all this kind of good stuff. And, of course, being a junior guru, I've got my table with my crew down front. And we're getting ready for the meeting, and I'm holding court up there, and I find out that, I'll be damned, Gary's going to be the speaker. If I had found out before I'd gotten to my table that Gary would have been the speaker, I would have never showed up for that meeting. I couldn't stand him, couldn't stand anything about him. Hated his story, particularly that story about financial amends. That made me real uncomfortable. But my ego kept me in the chair. See, my ego told me that if I get up and walk out of this meeting like I want to, everybody will wonder what's wrong with me. And I can't have that going on. So I sat there and I listened to the man I didn't like. Now here's another spiritual twist. He mentioned, he of course laid out that whole story. And I'm sure that was a lie, by the way. And he mentioned where his home group, and his home group was about 30 miles away, clear on the other side of town from where I am. But I, being a spiritual giant, I decided my new plan is I'm going to go to his home group. And I'm going to observe him, and I'm going to get the goods on him and expose him for the liar and fraud he is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I arrive at his home group, and, you know, some of you noticed this weekend, Gary's got that wonderful grin. You know, he's the first one to greet me at the door, and he says, I've been hoping you'd show up down here, and I'm going, well, they need me, you know. And I went, and if there was anything special about the meeting, I don't remember it. But there was something special after that meeting. And Gary grabbed me after that meeting and said, "Hey, I'm supposed to chair next week, but I've got a business commitment. I may not be able to be here. Would you chair for me?" And so, well, now they want me to run the meeting. I got to come back. See, I was never. And I found out later, I thought I had to be good and pure and all these things for God to be present and work in my life, and it's not that at all. If what I give God is resentment and hate and everything else, he'll work with that. He can do that just fine. And so I got drawn into that home group with Gary, and pretty soon there was one of those workshops organizing, and I was going to be a part of it. And see, I did in Alcoholics Anonymous approximately what I'd done when I went to college years before. I went over the field house, registered for all my classes, went and bought my books, joined a fraternity, threw the books in the closet, and started to party. Now, if you ran into me on campus and asked me what I was doing, I'd say, well, sir, I'm a pre-law student here at the University of Iowa. Well, that was technically true, except I wasn't almost ever going to class. And same thing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't miss a commitment, didn't miss a dance, didn't miss a roundup, didn't miss any of that stuff. I just missed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And somehow I've survived this long. And so we're getting ready to start that workshop, and even I can't be this phony for this long, so I called Gary up a couple days before then. He had an office near mine at that time, and I asked him if he had time for a cup of coffee, and he said, as a matter of fact, I'm free for lunch today. So we went and had lunch, and we chatted and eventually got down. I said, you know, I understand these workshops amongst the men, they're very intimate things, and before I start doing that with you, you need to understand I don't like you at all. And he laughed. And he told me that story he told you last night about Ernie and waving at each other with the finger salutes and all that kind of stuff. And he says, I reckon I'll be able to deal with you. And and he did. And see, this is when we're living in the world of the Spirit, the guy that I believe is ruining my life, who has nothing to offer me, anything else saves my life. It's the difference between me living in God's world and my world, you know. And what happens is the man I didn't really resent him. I envied him, and I envied his freedom. I wanted what he had. I couldn't say it, but I wanted what he had, and he was generous enough to give it to me. And I, further from a drink than I ever expected to be, I got my life changed in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's obviously a dear friend and a treasure in my life today. And part of the way he's taught me about how to be a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what he did for me, there's a signature point. He was talking about some events yesterday. One of those events where he'd had a little dishonest transaction at work. And I'm the new member at the group at this time. I'm the new member, the new guy. And the old timer, the old guy, screws up. Now, he does a 10-step. He doesn't go do it with the guru someplace. He goes and grabs the new guy and says, look at this shabby thing I did today. And laid it out for me. And I can't believe it, that he's telling me this and being this open about his shortcoming. And then and go through it, and here's what I think I'm going to do about it when I go back to work. He asked me for my input. I was smart enough not to give it. And and then he talked about, you know, some people we could help. And it turns out that's a real piece of our home group. See, we use the 10th step as an active 12-step tool. If it's part of me being part of God's recycling plan. See, I go out and I try my best to do what I need to do, and with my best intentions, I produce a bunch of garbage and I manage to harm people. But if I'm willing to put that in God's hands, like Gary was, and carry that to the new man, what I've got is a demonstration of how you're going to live a spiritual life, not a problem-free life, not an error-free life. And you know what? That draws people into a group and keeps them there. Now that's the point where I knew I really belonged there, because had an intimate confidence from one of the old timers in there, and I really learned something. I want to tell you about prayer. And then maybe an amend if I've got a chance. That marriage didn't last, and we divorced. And eventually my ex-wife and I have a good divorce today. We're good friends today. As a matter of fact, once we were able to be past the divorce and everything else, she and I went to the first thing we really did with each other was go to a PTA meeting. On the way back, I turned to her and I said, you know, amends had been, she's a member of the program, sober a year longer than I am. And I says, Lori, I says, you know, I think about the only bad feeling I got left about the divorce is that it interrupted our friendship. And she smiled at me, and she looked, and she said, Mike, don't you get it? She says, it was the marriage that interrupted our friendship. And that got put right. So I'm now being part-time dad, and I've Andrew's six, and I've got him over the weekend, and he says, Dad, he says, I'd like to go to a grown-up restaurant tonight. He says, I'm tired of all of McDonald's and Applebee's and all those kids' joints. He says, take me to a real restaurant tonight. And so I did. Now, you need to understand, by the way, this is one sharp kid. Don used to say he was a very old spirit. He and Andrew would go off in the corner together and chat. This boy, when he was 4 years old, I picked him up at daycare, and I'm bringing him home, and I'm telling him about something, and he turns to me, 4 years old, and he says, well, Mike, don't you think things might work better for you if you said the second thing that comes to your mind? At another point, not a lot older, he said to me, he says, Mike, you need to understand, he says, I've got plenty of friends. I need you to be my dad. He told me what he needed. So we're at the restaurant, and he's six, and it's Friday night, and we're having a good time, and all of a sudden I look around, and all these tables are filled with people in love. I mean, they're out there on dates, and I'm there with a six-year-old, for God's sakes. And the self-pity tsunami hits me. And now you've trained me enough, so I'm acting right by this time. I don't ditch the kid. But my head's awful busy. And took him home, watched the video, gave him a bath, put him to bed, and the minute his little butt hit that bed, I got my pen out, and I'm writing inventory, and I am angry. And I'll share that with you. God's name is in the first column because God did this to me. I don't know why. I also wrote a prayer here. God, please help me. I'm mad at you. I'm mad at God. Why? Because I don't have the relationship I want to have with a woman. I think God's always only going to give me the choice between having a sick relationship or no relationship. I'm lonely. People with less recovery, people that I sponsor, have better relationships than I do. I'm afraid that God will keep me in this pain because I'm more useful to others this way than if I have the relationship. You're a cold bunch. It gets worse. I feel like God has given me a gift of communicating with others, and the price of the gift is my own happiness. I'm mad because I know that only God can help me, and I don't believe He will. You know, I'd write this differently today, but as Gary was saying, you know, my life has been saved by imperfect inventory. What's this effect? Well, it affects my self-esteem because I feel like I'd sell out my principles to have this comfortable relationship. For example, I might do something like hitting on a newcomer. As a result, I feel like a phony. Don said, that's because you're a phony. It's distorting my sex relations. I'm having an increasingly emotionally unsatisfying sex-only relationship. Say, I was ahead of the curve. This was early 90s. I outsourced my sex life. Well, obviously, marriage and dating weren't working for me. So what I did is, and I can't cause harm around the program, so I find a gal who's not in Alcoholics Anonymous. No, we have an agreement, no dinner, no dates, no flowers, no movie. We just make dates to get together and play racquetball. And it ain't working. I find out, you know, this sounds like my ideal situation, but I'm finding out I'm not wired to live this way. My personal relations are affected. It keeps me jealous of others, comparing myself to them, coveting what they've got. I'm unwilling to share my pain. I feel ashamed, apart from, and flawed and different. My unbalanced drive in this area makes me vulnerable to getting drunk. Compromising my principles will get me drunk, and I know I don't have the strength not to do this. My mistakes here. Well, I'm absolutely not willing to give this to God because I don't think He's interested or willing to help me. See, isn't that interesting? With just one old idea, God doesn't care about my sex life or my happiness. I just put myself in a place where God can't help me. That's insane. I'm absolutely willing to sell out all my principles for relief. I'm impatient. I'm not willing to take an honest look at what this relationship won't do for me. I'm pretending the magic relationship's going to fix everything. And I want somebody else to fill me up and make me feel safe and secure. And only God can do that. Quickly, as soon as I got through writing that, I got on the phone and I called Gary up and read it to him. And Gary had some suggestions for me. My son was with me, so I couldn't leave. But he told me to go get the porn out of my place and put it in the trunk of my car and get rid of it as soon as I could. And, you know, we talked about a number of other things. And I start working my way west across the time zones. I end up in Denver, and I'm talking to Don, and I read it to Don, and at the end of it, he says, are you willing to work with me on this? I says, yeah. I says, I've had enough of me here. And he says, I want you to say this prayer in just this prayer. God, please teach me about love. I said, okay, Don. And I made another phone call. Didn't think much of it at the time. But I did start saying the prayer. And part of my deal with Don was that if I didn't like the results of his advice, I could call him back and complain about it. If I'd followed the directions. So a couple weeks later, I called him back and I said, Don, you need to know I don't think much of your damn prayer. And he says, well, tell me about that, cowboy. And I says, well, since I've been saying that prayer, the only woman that I was really interested in here and focused on, she got a job transfer out of town. And then I went to the doctor the other day, and he gave me some blood pressure medication that's made me impotent. And Don just laughed. He says, you misunderstood that prayer, didn't you? He says, I bet you thought that prayer was God get me a woman. He says, the prayer is, God, please teach me about love. He says, Mike, you're a guy who knows a lot about sex, but you don't know anything about love. Work with me on this. And so I continued. And sure enough, before too long, I fell wildly head over heels in love with my son. Now, he and his mother had always been a little tighter and had a little something more special, and so it seemed to me. And all of a sudden, the little barrier, we got along well, but that barrier just went away between us. And it's never really come back. He's a 23-year-old today that loves to call up and chat with the old man. After that, I fell in love with my ex-wife. Now, I didn't want to marry her again. Sorry, Tim. But what we both found out happened is what God did for us is God restored her to the place in my heart before my self-will took over, and I decided, you know, that marrying her would be more than just being her good friend. And so we had a lot of fun. She lives in another state now. I don't see her often. But if you want to exercise in humility sometime, swap fifth steps with your ex-wife. I did. And it's amazing. You know, the thing that made the most impact from that thing was that I realized what a small part I'd played in her life and how sad that was. You know, I assumed I was going to hear an inventory that was going to be all about me. And the sad thing was that I was so absent for her life, from her life, that there really wasn't that much about me. And I learned something there. And so did she. That prayer I started 18 years ago, and it's with me to this day, and eventually it led me into a relationship with just a wonderful woman by the name of Linda. And she's one of us and spoke around quite a bit. Went to Denmark, Canada, all over. Everybody loved her. Don loved her. It was a different thing. She was a woman I'd known and respected and admired. She was a hell of a good-looking woman. For a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. But she was married, and we were friends. But we did a lot of AA together and shared a home group for a while. And her husband died of got pancreatic cancer and died suddenly. After that, our relationship shifted. Now, I'm not too bright in this area, so she came up to. We'd been doing a workshop one Saturday for some people, and we're standing around the parking lot after their words, and this woman that I admire comes and says, "Mike, you need to know I love you." "Oh, well, that's nice, you know." I love you in AA is kind of like one of those air kisses, you know. "I love you, I love you, I love you." And she said, "No, you need to know that I really love you." And I reached out and gave her a hug, and she says, "No, I don't want that kind of a hug. Give me a real hug, you know." So it started, and I got a chance to be in love with and in relationship with a woman who is already a great friend and somebody I really admire in Alcoholics Anonymous, and somebody who Don did as well, and Gary. We had a wonderful time. Thanks really to Don, she decided that we needed to have the traditions present in our relationship. And I'll give you just a little snapshot that she came up to me one day shortly after we were now romantic, and she says, "Mike," she says, "I've written out the primary purpose for our relationship from my point of view." She says, "I think you should write yours down too, and we'll share them with each other." And as she would say later, her primary purpose was so detailed that it described the color, clarity, and weight of the diamond that I was supposed to purchase for. And that mine was so general that it could have covered my relationship with my cat. But now we got a place to start talking, you know. And you know, she is wonderful. She wasn't Saint Linda either. One of my favorite cards I got from her was this card. It's just a beautiful card, and I look at the front of it. It says, "You're my best friend. You're my lover. You're my soulmate." And I go, "Oh yes, I am." And I open it up, and on the inside it says, "And sometimes all three of you piss me off." We're engaged, and we did that right. We didn't move in together. We had a retreat locally, after that retreat, I was going to Santa Fe to hang out with some friends and do a little AA out there. And Linda lived on the west side and kind of near the airport, so I dropped my car off at her place and put it in the garage, and she'd drive me on to the airport. So I took off and went down to Santa Fe, and I spent a week down there, and when I when I came back, she was supposed to meet me at the airport, she wasn't there. And I called, and she wasn't there. Eventually, I understand she's not coming, and I got a cab, and I took a cab over to her place, and I got a key to the house, so I let myself in. I got to get my car, and I find her on the bathroom floor that she'd collapsed that morning with a stroke, and she was alive and conscious when I found her, but unable to speak, and got the paramedics coming, and we started a five-day period in neurointensive care, and it looked like there might be some hope for a while, and then we were told that there was no hope, that there had been renewed bleeding and caused pressure that crushed her brainstem, and that we needed to go to hospice. And so I'm spending the night in hospice, holding her hand while she dies, and I'm thank God for what Don had taught me up to that point. Because it seemed like the prayer sucked at this point. What do you mean, teach me about love? Look at what you're doing. And one of the things Don told me, he says, no matter what you do, Mike, there's always going to be at least two of you present. There's the man that's there who wants to genuinely be of help and do the right thing. And then there's the guy who's the self-centered one who is all about you. And he says, you can't do anything about that, but you can make sure the right guy's in charge. And so I'm standing there by the love of my life's bed while she dies, and there's a big piece of me going, this sucks, she's supposed to bury me. She's a lot younger than I am. She's in her mid-48. And there's the part that allowed me to be present there for that holy moment of her last breath. And then I got to see the contrast because, see, her family's a little different. We had siblings that were drinking at the hospital, and we had all the craziness going on, but I didn't have to be crazy. And I reflected back when my dad had died all those years before, and the last thing my dad ever asked me to do for him is he wanted to get up and use the bathroom. He didn't want to use the bedpan, and so I lifted him out of bed. And see, I couldn't stay very long in that hospital room. I had to keep running down to the garage and getting the bottle out from under the front seat of my car. And so when I picked up my dad to take him to the bathroom, he smelled the whiskey on my breath. And he didn't say anything, but I saw the pain in his eyes, and I saw his head turn away just that much. And I knew I'd hurt him. And so here I am all these years later, and I get a chance to do it differently. And I get a chance after this to have a new lesson about love. And the lesson of love is accepting your love. See, it's really nice. I like to be the guy who dispenses the love. It's a whole different situation, and frankly, for me, much more frightening to be the guy who's getting the love, because I can't control when you decide to turn it off. But I've found out how kind people are, and I got that chance, and it continues to this day. I keep experiencing the love and kindness of others in a way that I've never experienced before. I want to tell you quickly about an amend, and then we'll be done. I harmed a bunch of children. I was in a relationship with their mother, didn't marry her. When I hooked up with her mother, the girls were 2 years old and 5 years old. They'd been deserted by an alcoholic father. He was a real alcoholic. He drove a Harley and he was violent. I arrived wearing a cashmere coat with a bottle of Chateau Lafite under my arm and everything else, but all I really am is an alcoholic upgrade. I'm in these kids' lives for 5 years, and it's terrible. I thank God wasn't physically violent to them, but I was certainly emotionally violent to them. The one gal I passed out in the middle of her seventh birthday party, all this kind of stuff. When it came time to make amends, of course, the mother was on my list in the children. And I thought it was going to be easy because although we split as a couple, Jan to this very day is my barber. And so I'd been seeing Jan, and matter of fact, she still says today this. She says it's a testament to God's love that she can have a razor at my throat and I get out of that chair alive. But so I thought, you know, this is going to be one of those easy amends because we talk and we're friendly and all this kind of stuff. So I go and do what we do and I make amends to her, and then I get to that place. And says, "Is there anything you need to tell me?" And she had about 2 hours worth. And it starts off, and she says, "Mike, I can tell you're a good father. I see you bring Andrew into the barber shop, and I can see the way he acts around you, that he's not afraid of you, and he loves you a great deal, and you must really be a good dad to him." And I'm standing up waiting for my pat in the back, and she says, "And that really pisses me off." She says, "My girls deserve that from you, and you didn't give it to them. You ripped them off." And we went on. So at the end of the day, I said, "Well, Jan, the girls by this time are early teenagers. Is there anything, can I have your permission to try and make amends to them?" She says, "I don't know that I want you to have anything to do with them." And we talked some more, and she said, I'll tell you what, if you want, you can write them a letter. If they want to have anything to do with you, it'll be up to them. So I'll share with you what I wrote. And understand that this was with sponsors' help. I'm not smart enough to write this on my own. I wrote it on my own, but this is about draft number 6, you know, after the red pencils get taken care of. "Dear Summer, I'm writing to do what I can to set right the harm I did during the years that I was in a relationship with your mom. I've chosen to write rather than phone for 2 reasons. First, my handwriting is hard to read, and second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at later when life may be treating you rough. To tell you the truth, I'm tempted to let things just stay the way they are because your mom tells me you have a few good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I loved you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, I've done you harm. I'm sure you're aware that during the years we were together, I was an active alcoholic," and they made me put this next part in bold italics. "Let me be very clear that this in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions. I used alcohol and drugs because they were the only things I knew that could give me relief from the constant fear I felt. I was drawn to you and your family because I desperately wanted to love and be loved, but I was scared to death at the prospect of being responsible. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what was real. Is the real Mike the one who wants to love me or the one who pushes me away? You weren't crazy. I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What you got instead was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy, you were. I know at some deep emotional level, it's hard not to feel that if you were really worthy and valuable, that these things wouldn't have happened to you. Please believe me that this just isn't so. You are worthy and deserving love then and now. It was I that failed you. Summer, I hope you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms I've done you. Should you ever want to talk about any of this, please give me a call. If I can ever be of any help to you as a friend, I'd be honored." And then a P.S. that I'm sending a similar letter to her sister. I didn't hear anything right away, but I did get invited to her high school graduation. And that was nice, and we connected. And not long after the graduation, we got word that her biological father, bio dad, had died in Arizona. He'd hemorrhaged to death while drinking on a couch in a flop house and esophageal varices. And Summer called me up and she says, "Do you remember that letter you sent me a while ago?" And I says, "I sure do, Summer." She says, "You know, that was the letter that I always hoped I'd get from my dad. But since he'll never be able to send it, I think God had you send it for him." We got a little closer, and I got to be there some years later when she got married. I got a wonderful note, and then I got to be around when she later had her first baby, and she trusted me to hold that baby. And I want to tell you that, as Linda used to say, in any given day, I've got a choice. I can live in my world and have the consequences of that, or I can live in God's world and have the consequences of that. And that's my real choice. When I live in my world with my best of intentions, wanting to be a good guy, I harm and terrorize children. When I live in God's world, I get to be an instrument of healing for some poor drunk I never even got to know. I'm telling you from my bottom of my heart today, I'm so glad it's not fair, and I'm so glad that I'm with you. Thank you very much.